Now on Radio 4 to mark Remembrance Day, the second of three readings featuring extracts from the diaries of Edith Appleton. Edie worked as a nurse during the Great War, and her diaries record many of the horrors of conflict, as well as some rare but welcome lighter moments. It's November 1915, and Edie has been moved away from the front line to a hospital in Etretat on the Normandy coast. She must now supervise members of the Voluntary Aid Detachment, relatively untrained girls whose presence is occasionally trying. Rachel Atkins is the reader.
November 21st. Etretat. We arrived here at lunchtime yesterday and were kindly welcomed. The place is charming. Cold, wild, high cliffs, rocky shores, sandhills like home, the inevitable casino and multitudes of hotels where the casino followers live during the season. November 29th. Off for half a day. Could not do much as it was pouring with rain. The VADs are a source of great interest to me. Taking them as a bunch, they are splendid. They may be roughly divided into four sorts: stalkers, crawlers, the irresponsible butterflyers, and the sturdy pushers. At the moment, I'm thinking of a butterfly one who is on night duty in these wards and says with a light-hearted laugh, "It's ripping nursing! The men, great fun. When I was in the officers' ward, I did housework all the time. Great fun. But their men are really ill. Great fun." When I show her how to do anything fresh, she twitches to get at it and says, "Oh, do let me try. I'd love to do that. Simply love to." She is an aristocratic little person and most dainty and well-groomed, and the thought of her doing scrubbing and dusting all day makes me smile. The stalkers are nice girls, very lordly, with high-pitched, cracky voices. They look rather alarmed at some of the jobs they have to do, but do them well and with good grace. By crawlers, I mean the little people who think they are unworthy to do anything at all, with an expression of, "Stand on me, if you like, I should be pleased to be your doormat." There is little to say about the sturdy pusher ones. They are not remarkable for anything, but are quite reliable, very strong, never forget, and are always ready to do every bit of work. December 16th. Great excitement prevails over Christmas preparations. Each ward is secretly doing its utmost to outshine the rest. My men have made some lovely paper flowers and chains, and the orderlies have stolen quite a lot of greenery, and I hope they will steal more before the 25th. December 26th. Yesterday was a very busy day. Went to early service, then early to the ward. After the MOs visit each man, we gave a hot mince pie and a glass of claret. At 12, they had a huge feed in the big hall, all together. They look rather pretty sitting under the decorations in their blue clothes and cracker caps. We iced two of the cakes and lit fancy candles on them. After tea, they settled down to a sing-song amongst themselves. We had a good dinner, claret, champagne and port. The toasts were King George, for which we all rose in our places, then us, the sisters, for which the men rose, and after drinking the toast sang, "For they are jolly good fellows." January 30th. Hardly slept at all today. Nurses are the most inconsiderate wretches under the sun. They tramped about, slammed doors and pulled plugs to distraction. Then the orphans were let loose to kick tins and play. And the paper man blew his horn, toot-tooting, and yelling, "Petit Parisien!" March 8th. My heart is very sore for one poor boy. We have had him 10 days and he is no better, and is in a state to die at any moment. I'm writing to his mother and telling her so. She is evidently a refined old lady, writes back to say she is so glad to hear Charlie is with us. The rest and good food will do him good. Have my letters not reached her, or won't she understand that the boy is dying? March 13th. My poor little boy, Charlie Kerr, died yesterday. He'd been in 15 days suffering from gas, pneumonia, bronchitis, and has been extremely and dangerously ill all the time. But only the day before yesterday he realised that he was not going to get well. I'm glad to say we never left him, night or day, and he was fond of us all. Yesterday was a difficult day to be sister. He kept whispering all sorts of messages for home and his fiancée, and then he would call, "Sister," and when I bent down, would hear, "I do love you. When I'm gone, will you kiss me?" And all the time, heads would be popping in, "Sister, this and that." But in spite of all, I did kiss the boy. First for his mother, and then for myself, which pleased him. Then he whispered, "But you still will, when I'm gone." The night before, he asked me what dying would be like, and said it seemed so unsatisfactory. I told him it would be that little by little his breathing would get easier, and he would feel tired and like going to sleep. Then he would just sleep with no more fear, without a struggle. He was quite conscious up to 20 minutes before he died. I just asked him now and then if he knew I was still with him. "Yes, and you're quite happy, aren't you?" And he distinctly said, "Yes, quite." Then the last and very trying part for the sister was to walk along to the other end of the village, beside the poor dead thing, to see him decently put in the mortuary. June 7th. Less than no news, just a horribly short-handed muddle day, all the time trying to get the place clean. There is more cleaning to do there in comparison to the number of patients than anywhere I've ever nursed. In one house, for instance, a huge stone hall to be scrubbed, 4 flights of polished stairs to be kept immaculate, landings and all rooms the same, that is, 9 rooms and 2 kitchens. And when all is said and done, it is the accommodation for only 28 patients. The next house is as bad, the third worse, and the fourth worst of all. If only I could have a couple of good-sized marquees and be damned all this housework, we could get on with the patients. July 3rd. Our much-longed-for advance has begun after many days of heavy bombardment. We launched an attack at 7:30 on Saturday morning. They went over in waves, the second one so many minutes after the first, and so on. Where one man came from the first wave was wiped out, so was the second, which gave the Germans time to adjust their machine guns to receive the rest. After the second, they began to make headway and had them fairly on the run. We had a couple of train loads of wounded down, 1,100 in all, 153 officers, very dirty. The London Scottish kilts were a sight to behold. The next train of wounded is expected. I hear the calling bell going. I must be up, so no more now. July 6th. I give up description. It beats me. In ordinary times, we get a telegram from Abbeville saying a train with so many on board has left, coming to us. Then they stop giving numbers, just said, "full train." Now not even a telegram comes, but the full trains do. I have 41 German prisoners amongst my lot. How many English, I don't know. My Germans see very little of me, or of my VADs. Some must do without a woman's care and be left chiefly to orderlies, so with pleasure they may. July 17th. Convoy of 300-odd arrived at 1:30 p.m. Where they all went, I don't know. I only had 34. My poor little chest boy Lennox is dying. The lump of lead is in the diaphragm, causing an agony of pain and a poisonous abscess. I hope he will still be there this morning, so far as I am concerned. But for him, I wish him well away, where he only knows about happy things. July 19th. I hardly dare write down. My dying boy was a shade better yesterday. Perhaps we have yet to learn what the great physician can do. Or perhaps it was a flash of betterness I am longing to see this morning. August 8th. Convoy of 400 in. Sent an English convoy out. Busy day. I'm left with a family of 64, none seriously ill, except poor Lennox. He is so utterly weak that even to turn his head is hard work. I wrote for him to his mother and fiancée again yesterday, wanted him to tell me his own words, but all he said was, "I don't know what there is you could say." I knew his mother was his greatest anxiety, and wrote, "I am no stronger at all, but I have tried my hardest to take all my food and medicine and to get well." He said, "Yes, say just that." I don't think he will be detained longer than this week, and hope not for his own sake. August 9th. I had a terrible fierce lecture from my M.O. last night on not being married. He's a dear old thing, and says he has found marriage an undiluted success. So I told him, with the saddest look I could raise, that my day was done. It was too late. August 23rd. Lennox died soon after 8 o'clock last night. Never have I seen such a slow, painful death. It was as if the boy was chained to earth for punishment. Towards the end, it was agony for him to draw the little gasp breaths, and I felt I must clap my hand over nose and mouth and quench the flickering flame. I'm very glad for the boy to be away. October 1st. We had a convoy of 347 in yesterday, badly wounded. I only took 43 patients, German prisoners. They always fall to my share. 6 were slight cases, but the rest were shot to rags and putrid. One poor Saxon youngster got his wounds from his own bomb. He held it too long after the pin was out. As before, when I had the Germans, the whole population of Etretat turned out to see them carried in and made themselves such a nuisance that I shut the ground floor shutters. The youth of Etretat have been parading in front of the house, whistling and singing the Marseillaise, for the benefit of the Germans. Our own people are as bad. I find bunches of strange orderlies gazing at them. Make myself thoroughly unpleasant and banish the lot. I'm not going to keep a peep show. If they want to see Germans, I tell them to join an infantry regiment, and they will get what they want. October 5th. Just when I left off, the night super came to me and said there was going to be an evacuation soon after 6:30. I dressed and went with great joy and fixed up 20 of my Boches for England. Some were pleased to go. Some would rather have stayed here. And one old man was shaking with fright. He thought they were being taken to be shot. They were all profuse in their gratitude. One poor old Saxon stopped his stretcher by clinging to the seat in the hall as he passed and seized my hand and shook it, made me quite a long speech of thanks, etc., and presented me with his identity disc, a souvenir. October 21st. This morning is beautiful. Sky all colours of pale blue, pink and salmon, and all the boats and my veranda are white with hoarfrost. And now the warmth of the day is making itself felt. A cloud of steam is rising from the sea, just like it does over the marshes. If, for one short week, there could be no war, and all the men were well, what glorious walks, picnics we could have.